The Health and Human Services Committee will come to order. Sabrina, please call the roll.
Chair Fine.
Here.
Representatives Barrero.
Here.
Anderson.
Here.
Skidmore.
Here.
Amnesty, excuse, Baker.
Here.
Cross.
Here.
Dunkley.
Here.
Edmonds.
Present.
Grant. Hart.
Here.
Coster, excuse, Masula.
Here.
Persons Mullica. Blaken.
Here.
Salzman. Snyder. Excuse, Tribuzzi, excuse, Tuck.
Here.
Woodson. Yurkowski, excuse, quorum is present.
Thank you. Thanks, Sabrina. As we begin the meeting, please silence your cell phones. As always, we have two bills today. I don't anticipate they're going to take a huge amount of time. And then we're going to have a speaker, which I'm very excited about. Just one comment, and I don't expect this to be an issue today, but I want to make sure that folks understand that within our silo this session, I think we will be hearing bills that will have robust debate, and you know, we used to call them jump balls. And I just want members to know that there will be bills that may get agendaed that the chair may not like. But, you know, in the spirit of having an open and honest conversation on these things, you'll see them. And I think we'll see some of those in some of our subcommittees this week. But I just want folks to know that. It's something I enjoyed when I was a freshman. It's something that I miss a little bit since. And I'm going to do my part to kind of bring the idea of jump balls back into the process. So stay tuned on that. But with that, I don't anticipate these two will be challenging, but if they are, they are. We're going to start with Representative Bell with CS for HB 201, emergency refills of insulin and insulin-related supplies or equipment. Representative Bell, you are recognized to present the bill.
Vice Chair Barrero, Ranking Member Skidmore, and committee members, thank you so much for hearing loud and clear.
We're trying to turn down the volume a little bit.
Do you want me to step back?
No, it'll be okay.
Okay, in 2016, Florida added emergency refills of insulin to our state statute. 22 states have passed some form of emergency insulin refill legislation known as Kevin's Law. Following the tragic death of Kevin Housechel in Ohio, over the New Year's holiday, Kevin's prescription for insulin ran out of refills, and he was unable to contact his pharmacy or his doctor, and a pharmacy would not renew it, and Kevin ended up passing away that evening. So this bill is for diabetic patients, type 1 and type 2, to be able to get an emergency refill. As everybody knows sitting on this panel, my oldest daughter, Ashley, is a type 1 diabetic, juvenile diabetic. We were over at the beach on vacation last summer, and she was filling her insulin pump, and there was a hole in the bottom of it, and all the insulin ran out. This is at 7 in the evening on a Sunday evening. She calls her doctor at Mayo Clinic. Of course, nobody answers the phone. It's like, what do we do? The only alternative was to go to the emergency room in order to get this insulin. And if she would have had an emergency refill, we could have just, you know, stayed out of the emergency room. And so this is not only going to help people like her, but it's also going to help the citizens of the state of Florida save money. And that is my bill, sir.
Thank you. Having presented the bill, members, are there any questions? Okay, seeing none, we do have no amendments, and so we will move on to public testimony. We have four individuals wishing to waive in support. Karen Murillo with AARP, Michael Fisher with PPSC, Ron Watson with the Florida Renal Coalition, and Amanda Frazier with the American Diabetes Association. That is the end of public testimony. Is there anyone wishing to debate? Representative Woodson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to make my debate very quick. Well, Bell, thank you so much for this bill. It's a life and death situation when it comes to insulin, and all you're trying to do, you're trying to save life. So I really appreciate it. I supported it, and I'm going to support it again. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Hart, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep, I thank you very much. My nephew was a juvenile diabetic. He died 2 years ago. Just because, not because he wasn't getting all he needed. He just gave up because he'd been diabetic since he was 14. So I want to thank you for this because I do know that there were times that he needed his meds and he could not get them readily. So I am grateful for you passing this bill, and I look forward to supporting it all the way to the end. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else wishing to debate? Yes, you're recognized. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Rep. Bell, thank you so much for this bill. When I saw this bill, I reached out to one of my constituents, and he wanted me to say thank you because if he didn't have the number of his doctor, many times he travels a lot for work. If he didn't have the number for his doctor, he would not have been able to get his diabetes medication. So thank you very much for this bill.
You're welcome.
On behalf of my constituent.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Seeing none, you're recognized to close on your bill.
I will just wave close.
All right. Having closed on her bill, Sabrina, please call the roll on HB 201 and announce the vote.
Representatives Barrero.
Yes.
Anderson.
Yes.
Skidmore.
Yes.
Amnesty. Baker.
Yes.
Cross.
Yes.
Dunkley. Yes. Edmonds. Yes. Grant. Yes. Hart.
Yes.
Coster. Masula.
Yes.
Persons Mullica. Lincoln.
Yes.
Salzman. Snyder. Trabuzzi. Tuck.
Yes.
Woodson.
Yes.
Yurkowski. Chair Fine.
Yes.
14 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Show the bill reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you, Chair and members.
All right. Next up, our second and final bill is HB 227, intravenous vitamin treatment by Representative Garcia. Representative Garcia, you are recognized to present your bill.
Hello? Okay, there we go. Good afternoon, Chair Fine, Vice Chair Borrero, Whip Anderson, Ranking Member Skidmore, and members of the subcommittee. I would like to begin by thanking you for allowing me to present House Bill 227, Intravenous Vitamin Treatment, also known as the Stephanie Belias Act. Intravenous vitamin therapy is a relatively recent medical trend that involves administering a high-dose mixture of vitamins, minerals, electrolytes, and other fluids directly into a patient's bloodstream. This treatment is different from other applications of IV therapy in that it is frequently used among otherwise healthy individuals with goals ranging from achieving a general feeling of wellness to curing a hangover. However, the issue with the therapy is not that it's not regulated by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Additionally, it doesn't require a physician referral and could be provided without first obtaining a patient's complete medical history or recent blood work. Another problem is that many of those partaking in treatments aren't aware of its effects or risks. The treatment could be especially dangerous for individuals with heart disease and kidney problems. The IV treatment can also cause allergic reactions from poorly interacting with other medications being taken by their patient. Without reviewing the patient's current blood work, for example, sudden changes and electrolyte balances could cause fatal cardiac arrhythmia and other complications that need immediate medical care. Stephanie Belias, whom the bill is named for, died from an IV treatment. Stephanie was 25 years old, a nursing student with no health issues or allergies. It took a year for the family to find out that the cause of death. Finally, the coroner's office found the cause of death to be selenium poisoning from the IV administered to her. I decided to file this bill because I did not want there to be another Stephanie Belias. With your favorable support, this bill will instruct the Board of Nursing of Medicine and Board of Osteopathic Medicine to adopt the following rules. First, it would require patients to complete a self-screening risk assessment questionnaire before receiving the treatment and would prohibit healthcare providers from administering the treatment to patients for whom it would be unsafe. It would also mandate healthcare patients to provide and warn patients of the potential side effects and risks of intravenous treatment and when they would need to seek medical attention. Once administered, healthcare providers would be instructed to notify a patient's designated physician and maintain a written plan for emergency care. We passed this bill last year in the House, but it didn't move in the Senate. I'm hoping that this year it'll move in the Senate with your favorable support. That is the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, are there questions? Seeing none, there are no amendments, and there is no public testimony. Anyone wishing to speak in debate? You're recognized. Representative Cross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, I just want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. This is something that I think it's very appropriate that we are regulating and making sure that any IV treatment is supportive of the patients, their needs, and any other conditions they may have. I've even been at running races where at the end there's booths offering IV treatment, and you know, there's no way to know if that's going to help someone or hurt them. So I do think that we can save lives with this bill, and I hope it gets across the finish line in both chambers this session.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to speak in debate? Okay, seeing none, you're recognized to close.
I waive close, Mr. Chair.
Sabrina, please call the roll on HB 227 and announce the vote.
Representatives Barrero?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Skidmore?
Yes.
Amnesty? Baker?
Yes.
Cross?
Yes.
Dunkley?
Yes.
Edmonds? Yes. Grant? Yes. Hart? Yes. Coster? Masula?
Yes.
Persons Mullica?
Yes.
Blaken?
Yes.
Salzman? Snyder? Trabuzzi? Tuck?
Yes.
Woodson?
Yes.
Yurkoski? Chair Fine?
Yes.
15 yeas, zero nays, Mr. Chair.
Show the bill reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. You all have a great day.
Thank you. All right, well, that concludes the bill hearing part of our meeting. We're now going to have a presentation on international drug reference pricing, a subject we spent a fair amount of time on last week, but we have another great speaker to speak about it. Members, today we're going to have a presentation from Mr. Avik Roy with the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. His organization established an index comparing relative market orientation of various countries, and he's here to talk about the international drug market and options for states to use international reference pricing. He's a very smart guy. Some of us spent time with him this morning before the meeting as a graduate of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, so second best university in Cambridge. Mr. Roy, you are recognized to give your presentation.
Chairman Fine and Ranking Member Skidmore and Majority Leader Grant, pleasure to be here with all of you. And I hope this presentation is useful. I've been told that you guys hate presentations, so hopefully this one is interesting enough that you don't walk out of the room, and I look forward to your questions and comments. So just to tell you a little bit about my organization, the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, I founded it with some colleagues in 2016. And we are a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank, and our mission is to expand economic opportunity to those who least have it. And one thing that's interesting about our approach to that is we are committed to using the tools of free enterprise, individual liberty, technological innovation, and pluralism to achieve the expansion of economic opportunity. So our whole idea is that, you know, with all of the partisan divides we have in our country, we're trying to build bridges and show that progressive social outcomes can be achieved using innovation and economic freedom. And so we commit to everything we work on exclusively focused on how to improve the lives of Americans whose incomes or wealth are below the U.S. median, and we are a traditional 501c3 funded exclusively by charitable donations. So this is a chart that I'm sure you're all familiar with, which is just the progression of median household income in Florida, which has recovered since the financial crisis of 2008. But what's really interesting is that if you actually add in or incorporate or monitor the rise of out-of-pocket healthcare costs, the picture looks grim. And by out-of-pocket costs, I'm not just talking about copays and deductibles. I'm also talking about the share of insurance premiums that are being paid out-of-pocket by employees instead of being fully paid for by the employer. So it's coming not just out of your paycheck before you see it, but after you get your paycheck. And if you factor in those rising out-of-pocket costs, which don't get counted as part of income statistics, because it's sort of like it's after you get your income, the actual trend in inflation-adjusted income growth is negative 0.7% a year in Florida. So the greatest threat to the living standards of Floridians, despite all the amazing growth that you've had in the state, is the rising cost of healthcare. And this is just a chart that shows us in a different way, which is if you look at the components of the consumer price index and break them out by category, there are certain categories that are actually going down over time, things like telephone, you know, cell phones and computer software and wireless telephone services. And what's going up? It's childcare, it's college tuition, and it's healthcare. Now, one thing you'll hear people say, since today we're focused on drug prices, is that why should we really focus on drug prices? Drug prices are only 8% of national health expenditures. They're really not as big of a driver, some would argue, as things like hospital care, 27%, and physician services, 17%. That's true to a degree. So one thing that that statistic doesn't fully explain is that that's only looking at retail pharmaceutical spending, like drugs that you purchase at a CVS or a Walgreens, not drugs that are administered in a hospital setting or in a physician office, like intravenous infusions. Now, if you look at it a different way, which is if you are on employer-based insurance, if you're on in private insurance, what are the components of your premiums? Prescription drugs actually represent, in total, about a quarter of your insurance premium. That's a lot, right? That's on par with what the average non-elderly person who's not on Medicare in particular, because that's who gets private insurance. For someone who's under 65, a quarter of your spending is drugs, and roughly 18% is hospital care, and another 40% is physician care or outpatient care. So the drug component is pretty significant. You all know, of course, that what we spend on drugs is more than any other country in the world. On a per capita basis, we basically spend about double what comparable countries spend on drugs. What is often less appreciated, but I gather that you all are well briefed on because you had a meeting about this last week, is that America leads the world at the prescription of generic drugs. Literally, we are number one in the world at replacing branded drugs for generic drugs, unbranded generic drugs, where it's appropriate. 86% in 2015, it's now about 90% of all prescriptions in the United States are for unbranded generic drugs that are literally cheaper than this bottle of water I'm holding in my hand to buy at the pharmacy. So that's pretty amazing. So you'd think, okay, if we're leading the world in the share of our prescriptions that are for generics, and our generics are really inexpensive, how is it that we're spending double what every other country is spending on prescription drugs? How's that possible? Right? We're actually the best country in the world at replacing branded drugs for generics. So we should have the cheapest spending compared to other countries on prescription drugs. So why isn't that happening? And the reason is specifically that what we're spending on biologic drugs is skyrocketing. So you look at small molecule drugs versus biologics, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with this distinction, but just so that we're all on the same page, small molecules are conventional drugs that you can synthesize in a chemistry lab. Biologics are genetically engineered drugs that are manufactured in biological living cells. It's a relatively new technology. It's basically a couple decades old in terms of actual medicines that people take every day. And the laws and rules that govern biologic drugs, and particularly generic biologic drugs, are completely different, as we'll talk about, than small molecules. So small molecule spending, and this is not inflation-adjusted dollars. This is actual nominal spending nationally. We're actually spending less today on small molecule drugs than we spent in 2013. Because so many of these drugs have gone off patent and have gone generic, for those traditional drugs, like the drugs that you take to lower your blood pressure or your cholesterol or things like metformin for diabetes or antidepressants, these are your classic small molecule drugs that a lot of people get as prescriptions and have gone generic, and now we actually spend less on them today. So if we're spending less on small molecules than we spent in 2013, and again, this isn't even adjusting for inflation, so if you add in the inflation, it's even more savings. Are we having a drug spending crisis? We shouldn't be. We should be celebrating the fact that drug spending is actually going down over time. But here's the rub. What we're spending on these biologic drugs is skyrocketing. We're spending almost more than double, actually, now what we spent 10 years ago on biologic drugs. Biologic drugs today represent 3/5, 59% of drug spending net of PBM rebates, which is remarkable because, you know, this is, as I said, a relatively new technology. It's more remarkable for some other reasons I'll get to. So if you look at the spending growth, it's the reason I'm bringing this up is to say the drug pricing crisis we have is about a specific category of drugs. And we'll get into why that is. But if you look again at small molecules, what we spend on small molecule drugs is declining. What we're spending on biologics is dramatically increasing. And what's even crazier is that biologics represent less than 1%
of all prescriptions in the United States. This is not an 80-20. This is like a 99-1. Right? So this category of drugs that represents less than 1% of prescriptions represents 60% of drug spending net of rebates. That is the specific problem with the high price of prescription drugs we have in the United States. The small molecule side, there's imperfections, there's this and that. You may remember the debates we had a few years ago when drugs came on the market to cure hepatitis C. There was a lot of concern about the high price of those drugs. Over time, that complaint has gone away because competition has come in. Those drugs are more affordable now, and over time, they'll go generic, and then we won't be worried about the price of those drugs anymore. Unfortunately, for biologic drugs, that equation doesn't apply. Those drugs can be in the market for 10, 15, 20, 30 years, and the prices don't really come down. In fact, they only go up. Why is that? So the reason is that small molecules and biologic drugs are governed by two completely different congressional statutes. The first category, the small molecule drugs, is governed by the Hatch-Waxman Act of 1984, which did a brilliant job of streamlining the way generics come on the market. Under Hatch-Waxman, there's a small category of patents that the branded manufacturer can hang its hat on and say, okay, if you violate these patents, you can't launch your generic drug. Once those patents expire, the generic drug can come on the market. The generic drug manufacturer has to prove pretty limited amount of stuff to the FDA about how identical their drug is to the branded drug, and then they can launch. And what's really cool about the United States and a big driver of why in America we're able to do a great job of substituting those generic drugs for the branded drugs is if your doctor writes a prescription for Lipitor for you to lower your cholesterol, and you take that to Walgreens, the pharmacy can automatically substitute generic atorvastatin instead of giving you Pfizer-branded Lipitor. They don't have to ask the doctor for permission to do that. They don't have to ask the patient. They can just give you the generic prescription. Now, if you insist on branded Lipitor and want to pay for it, that's your choice, but they don't have to go through those bureaucratic hurdles to give you that prescription. That's why when generics get on the market, they take over very quickly because they're so much less expensive. They get massive share, about 80% market share in about 6 months, and an 80% price discount to the branded drug. That's not how it works for these biologic drugs. Biologic drugs are governed by a completely different congressional statute called the Biologic Price Competition Innovation Act of 2010. Under that law, which was affected much more by pharmaceutical and biotech interests, the FDA requires that you have to do these very costly phase 3 clinical trials that cost hundreds of millions of dollars to prove that your generic biologic or quote-unquote biosimilar is clinically equivalent to the branded product. The therapeutic substitution at the pharmacy level is on a case-by-case basis, and it's regulated at the state level. A lot of states require you have to ask the doctor or the patient or both for permission to substitute the drug. As a result, generic companies have to hire sales forces, basically to actually get the doctors to realize that there's this biosimilar product out there that they should prescribe instead of the branded drug. So we create all these hurdles. And also, there's many more patents. Unlike the streamlined patent process for small molecules, for biologics, we have this very complex patent process. There can be 75 or 100 patents that the generic company has to navigate, many of which are very trivial, have nothing to do with the innovation of the actual original product. And if you violate any single one of those patents, you can't launch your generic. You have to get through all 75 of those patents. If you get 74 out of 75, you can't launch. If you do, you pay treble damages in court. So the risks and the upfront costs for launching a biosimilar drug or a generic biologic are very, very high. And they're only basically being done for the biggest sellers, like Humira, like Herceptin, the very biggest drugs that are selling billions and billions of dollars a year. Those handful of drugs, 5 to 10, are getting biosimilar competition, but the price discounts are only about 20 to 30%, not 80%, and their market shares are much lower because of all these hurdles. For all the smaller biologic drugs that might sell 100 million a year or 200 million a year, they're not getting any competition because the costs and risks up front for the biosimilar manufacturer are so high, it's not worth it to them to launch. So Congress, unfortunately, has messed up the way the biologic market works. Another problem is that the Food and Drug Administration has been very slow in approving biosimilars. They're starting to catch up, but the European Medicines Agency, which is the equivalent of the FDA for the EU, they've been much better at approving a lot of these biosimilar drugs, and as a result, they have more options for competition. So the end result is, if you look at the market for branded biologics and then layer onto that how much are we selling of biosimilar drugs, it's nothing. It's nothing compared to what we talked about with the generics. So FDA and Congress and the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office have all basically, with perhaps good intentions, but thoughtlessly in the end, created a market, a biotech market or a biosimilar market that doesn't work. And the relative savings, here's an example. What we actually did some, my colleague at FreeOp, Greg Gervin, did an analysis where he said, here's what we could have saved if we had just had the European Union's competition policies around approving more of these biosimilars, around allowing those biosimilars to get substituted to the pharmacy. If we had just done all the things in the right way, or at least in the way that Europe had done it, then we could have saved $30 billion in drug spending over a 15-year period from 2015. To 2019, particularly with those three on the right, or four on the right, Rituxan, Enbrel, Remicade, and Humira. The last three drugs are drugs for rheumatoid arthritis and psoriatic arthritis. Rituxan is an anti-cancer drug. The most important thing to understand is that we don't have a free market for the way we price and pay for prescription drugs. A lot of people who advocate for higher drug prices say, if you try to have lower drug prices, you're a socialist. This is the way the free market works. You should trust that capitalism is good and that this is the result of capitalism, the system that we have today. I'm here to argue that is absolutely not the case. This is not a free market. For one thing, state and federal mandates often force insurers to pay for drugs irrespective of their price or clinical value. There are regulations at the state level and the federal level that say, to an insurer, you must cover this drug irrespective of what it costs because, for example, in the Affordable Care Act, there's a rule that says, and this is common in employer-sponsored insurance, that your plan has to cover two drugs in every therapeutic class, a minimum of two drugs in every therapeutic class. But what if there's only one drug in a particular therapeutic class and there aren't five, right? If there's two out of five, that's one thing. You can negotiate and say, okay, we'll cover the two best value drugs out of the five. But what if there's only one drug in that class? Then you have no choice but to cover that drug, irrespective of if the drug company wants to charge $1 million for it. And so that gets passed on to consumers and employers in the form of higher premiums. Another thing we talked about already, which is the suppression of biologic drug competition. There's the fact that consumers and in the employer-sponsored system have little visibility into how high-cost drugs affect their premiums. We talked about the fact that your insurance premiums, about 25% of the cost of your insurance is prescription drug spending. But almost no consumers know that because all you know is you get this chunk taken out of your paycheck and you think you have insurance. You have no idea why your premiums keep going up and your wages keep going down. You just know that it's getting more expensive every year. You know what you're paying in your copays, and that's about it. One of the biggest factors that I want to point out to you is everything I've shown you today has been sort of, backwards facing. The future is going to be even more challenging because more and more of the drugs that get launched and approved by the FDA are going to be biologics because the industry knows that they have the incentives to generate these biologic drugs where the competition is more stifled. And then the next wave are these things called cell-based therapies. You may have heard of these, and I'm sure you've had hearings on cell-based therapies, particularly in the cancer setting or for sickle cell anemia, where you take someone's cells out, you genetically modify them, put them back in the patient, and are able to treat diseases that had been heretofore untreated. Important innovations, important medical advances, we all celebrate that. But at the same time, there's no generic pill for that kind of treatment. So once the biotech company or the pharma company has gotten their 10 years of returns on their R&D investment, what do? You just let them have a monopoly forever, or do you find some way to introduce competitive pricing in? That's the problem that you all are going to face. So what can Florida do? I would argue that Florida can do a couple of things. You're already doing one of them, which is thinking about legalizing drug importation from other countries like Canada. That's, I would say, an important short-term fix. It's amazing and impressive that the FDA is finally allowing this to happen. We'll see how much of an impact that has. I would say the impact's going to be relatively modest because Canada's one-tenth the size of the United States. They can't supply the U.S. pharmaceutical market. Maybe Florida, you know, because, you know, Florida's about the same size as Canada. But you can't. That's not a sustainable model for the country, number one. Number two, Canada actually has the second highest drug prices in the world because they what they pay in their system is benchmarked off of U.S. prices to some degree. So the Canadian prices, even though we talk about it all the time, aren't actually that low. They're actually relatively high in the international context. One thing you can do is you can start to work back some of these state coverage mandates for prescription drugs. So, you know, our friends in the pharmaceutical industry don't like talking about being more aggressive about negotiating drug prices. They say that's socialism, but they're okay with the socialism of forcing insurers to cover their drugs and pay for them regardless of their price or clinical value. That's not what you do in a free market. In a free market, you give the insurers the choice. If they think, if people want to pay for that drug, then that's fine. But if that drug doesn't have the value, if the drug company is overcharging, they should have the leverage to be able to negotiate to say, no, we're not going to cover that drug unless you give us a price that we think is reasonable. We don't allow that in a lot of cases, and I understand why we don't, because we want to guarantee coverage for certain types of treatments. But the consequence of that is we take that pricing negotiation power away from payers and basically give it all to the drug companies. And they, I assure you, take advantage of that pricing power. Another thing we can do is adopt international reference pricing for drugs, whether it's for Medicaid enrollees, for public employees, or even people in the general employer-sponsored insurance system, especially for these biologic drugs and individualized therapies, which for the reasons I've been describing is where the pricing problem really lies. We'll get into that more in a minute. Another thing you can do is you can index reimbursement growth for prescription drugs to the consumer price inflation. So, okay, if AbbVie wants to raise the price of Humira every year, that's fine, but don't raise it 16%. Raise it 3% or 4% or 2%, whatever CPI ends up being. Another thing we can do is require insurers or employers to disclose to consumers the major components of insurer costs. So consumers can be more informed about what's driving their increased healthcare costs. Because maybe what that does is give consumers more information. Say, hey, I don't like the fact that my hospital costs of my insurance plan have gone up so much. Why is that? What's happening there? And they can start, you know, that creates a sort of bottoms-up pressure for more value care, value-based care and lower prices. So let's talk specifically about international pricing indexes and benchmarks. So this is a common strategy in Europe, in almost every European country and in Canada. One of the tools they use to negotiate drug prices is to say, let's look at all of our peer countries and see what they're paying for these drugs and create a benchmark that we then use as a basis for negotiating our drug prices. When Donald Trump was president, he tried to institute a regulation for Medicare that would negotiate these kinds of prices in Medicare Part B and Medicare Part D, so both for physician-administered drugs and for drugs that you buy at a retail pharmacy like CVS or Walgreens. And what he did was say, let's take this basket of countries that are, also advanced industrialized countries, the Spain, Sweden, Italy, France, Germany, the typical countries we'd look at, and let's just say, what's the average price in all these countries, and let's have Medicare pay that instead of what Medicare pays today, and that will save money for seniors in terms of lower Medicare premiums and also reduce the cost of funding the Medicare program. So taxpayers win and seniors win. It's kind of a win-win. Now, the Trump administration got a lot of pushback for that plan from the pharmaceutical industry, which argued that if you use this kind of method, then you're importing socialism in the United States because some of the countries on that list are single-payer countries that basically, as a government, just says, we're going to pay this price, and that's socialism, and that's bad, and why would we want to import socialism? Why would the Trump administration want to import socialism in the United States? And for reasons we can get into, that's an oversimplification. Basically, you know, if you're a single-payer country, let's say, or the UK, and you're negotiating a price for a particular drug, like, let's say, the hepatitis C drugs, it's kind of like being a bulk purchaser. Gilead Sciences, the manufacturer of the hepatitis C cure, they don't have to sell the drug to the UK. If they think your price is unreasonable, they can pull out of the market and say, you know what, we're not going to sell our hepatitis C drug to you because it's, you know, your price is too low. And then the UK loses access to this cure for hepatitis C. So it's not just the governments in this context that have leverage. Pharmaceutical companies, if they've developed a drug that's a real treatment or a real cure for a disease, if they're adding real clinical value for patients, they have a lot of leverage too. And that's why the prices that these countries, single-payer countries, negotiate is never zero. It's always something that the pharmaceutical companies are willing to accept. Having said all that, we at FreeOp came up with our own version of the index where we said, okay, let's stipulate that. Let's say that we don't want to incorporate single-payer countries' negotiations into a benchmark, an international benchmark. So let's eliminate all the single-payer countries, which on this list are the ones that are in orange, and let's just use the countries that are not single-payer. Then what happens? So what we did is we created an index that only includes countries that don't have single-payer healthcare, with the exception of Denmark, because Denmark, while it has single-payer health insurance, they have a very interesting market-based way of determining drug prices. So we kept them. But we eliminated everybody else, and we particularly said we're going to heavily weight four countries, Denmark, Netherlands, Singapore, and Switzerland, which have the most market-based systems for negotiating drug prices. And it turns out the Trump administration actually looked at our analysis, looked at our proposal, and they compared the two. They said, okay, let's look at what prices would be spit out, what the benchmark would spit out if you use our approach, and what would be spit out if you used FreeOp's approach, the Trump administration saying this. And they found it was almost exactly identical. So if you use a more market-based international index, the benchmark price for most of the major drugs that they looked at, all the major drugs they looked at, was basically the same as if you use this one that included the single-payer countries. You get the same result in terms of negotiated prices that are more affordable for Americans, but you do so by rewarding and modeling American prices after the countries that have the most market-based systems or free market-based or competition-based systems for determining what prices they pay for prescription drugs. The one thing you hear from the industry is, well, if you try to do this, if you try to take a hard line on drug prices, you'll lose access to life-saving medicines. And that is completely untrue. And there's a simple reason why. The United States is the largest pharmaceutical market in the world. If a pharmaceutical company says, we are not going to sell drugs in the United States, their shareholders would destroy them. Their stock price would get cut in half. I used to work on Wall Street. I used to build these financial models. There is no country, there's no company that would forego the U.S. market because the market is just too big. And this is what we see in Europe. What we see in Europe is that the countries that get the fastest access to drugs, which are the ones on the top left of this chart that you're looking at. So if left and up is good. Left means that is the average amount of time to market after the drug's been approved by the European Medicines Agency. And up, the y-axis, is the percentage of drugs that's been approved by the EMA that are online and being sold in that country. And the top left country is Germany. And the next highest country is the UK. Germany has a more market-based healthcare system. UK is more of a socialized system, single payer, et cetera. They both do very well in terms of market access. Why is that? Because they're two of the largest countries in Europe. So if you're a pharmaceutical company, you're like, you know what? I may not like the fact that the UK takes a hard line or Germany takes a hard line on the price, but it's too big of a market to ignore. So pharmaceutical companies prioritize selling their drugs into the largest markets. And the United States is the largest market by a country mile. And there is no way any pharmaceutical company will pull out of the United States. And specifically in the context of Florida, this really matters because you all have a unique opportunity. If you took on a model like this, a pricing model like this, no drug company is going to walk out of Florida. You're too big of a market in the context of the United States for a company to say, you know, if we pull out of this market, you're going to cut off your nose to spite your face. One thing I want to highlight, so you hear people say, well, you know, one thing you hear people say, or some people have argued, is that if you actually try to take a hard line in negotiating drug prices, then drug companies are going to compensate for that by increasing their launch prices for the drug. So, okay, if you're going to negotiate what I can charge 10 years after launch, then I'm going to make up for that by charging higher prices up front. That's an argument some industry advocates have made that has been repeated by others in academia. That's not the case. That won't happen, and I'll tell you why. When you launch a drug in the beginning, and again, I, as someone who used to invest in biotech companies, we saw this all the time. When you launch a drug in the beginning, you're really concerned about getting on the formularies. You want insurance companies to cover your drug. If you don't get access to formularies, if insurers don't cover your drug, you have no sales. So you keep your price low in the beginning so you can get on all the formularies. Now, after everyone's been on your drug for 4, 5, 6 years, that's when you start to raise prices. If you've got multiple sclerosis and you've been on a certain drug for a couple years and your disease is reasonably well managed on that drug, every doctor is trained to keep you on that drug because you're well maintained on it. The drug companies know that, so they wait until you're on the drug and you don't want to switch off of it to charge 16% more year after year after year after year. So if you, what this table is showing you is that when you look at what are the components of higher drug spending, it's the contribution is largely older drugs where you've been on the drug for a long time, you don't want to be switched to something else just purely on price, and so you're stuck on that drug, sort of, and drug companies take advantage of that to charge more. Now, here's a specific case study, which is Humira, which has been, for most of the last 10, 15 years, the biggest selling drug in the United States. It's manufactured by a company in Chicago called AbbVie. Now, most of the growth in AbbVie sales, or Humira sales and AbbVie sales, is from price increases. So if you look at the dark blue section of this chart, what that's showing you is how much Humira sold in 2011 in the U.S., which was $2.8 billion. Okay? The lighter blue is showing you volume growth. So if they didn't raise prices at all and only saw their sales growth increase from more prescriptions from Humira, they would have gotten to about $6 billion in sales in 2020, over that 10-year period. It would have gone from $2.9 billion to $6 billion. So it would have roughly doubled. That's still pretty good performance, right? Most people would say, hey, you double your sales in 10 years, that's pretty good. Now, the orange part of this chart is the price increases. So that's what they made purely by just charging more for the drug, irrespective of the amount of the drug they sold. So if you actually tease that out and say, okay, how much did they make on price increases versus actually selling more quantity of the drug? They made about $43 billion purely from price increases. Now, what AbbVie would argue is we needed to charge that $43 billion to consumers and to governments because that allows us to be innovators. We pour that money into R&D, and that R&D leads to new cures for diseases, and that's why you need to let us charge this extra $43 billion. Now, how many drugs did AbbVie develop, new drugs did AbbVie develop in its own labs over that 10-year period? One drug. So $43.8 billion of price increases led to one new drug being developed in AbbVie's own labs. Now, the average across all studies is that inclusive of failures in R&D, it costs about $1 billion to develop a new drug, bring a new drug to market. So AbbVie was 1/44th as productive in R&D as the average biotech company. So no, they didn't actually need $44 billion to develop one new drug. They wasted a lot of that money on unproductive R&D, on sales and marketing, on a lot of other factors that actually didn't contribute to new innovation. Why is that? It turns out that large companies are massively unproductive when it comes to developing their own drugs, because they're bureaucratic, because they don't have the same growth level. So if you're a talented scientist, you don't want to work at AbbVie. You want to start your own company and have stock options in that company. So if that drug makes it to the FDA and that startup is worth $1 billion, you're worth $100 million as the founder of that company. You don't get those kinds of opportunities at Pfizer or Merck or AbbVie, where you just get a plaque on the wall as Employee of the Year and move on to the next thing. So the mediocre scientist or the sort of average scientist, I don't say mediocre is probably a pejorative term, but you don't get those exceptional scientists at the big companies. All the exceptional talented scientists go to startups that are unprofitable. That's where all the money is made. Most of the drugs that we think of as big pharma drugs, weren't developed in their own labs. They were acquired. They basically bought another company to sell that drug. That's what happened with hepatitis C. The hepatitis C cure, Sovaldi, was not developed by Gilead. It was developed by a startup company called Pharmacet that Gilead paid $11 billion to buy, doubling the acquired company's stock price. And then they charged, you know, 5x as much for the drug to make up the cost of their acquisition. That's financial engineering. That's not innovation, right? So they're using these extra profits from price increases to buy a lot of companies that are developing the new drugs. But they're not developing those new drugs in their own labs. Those drugs would have been developed anyway. One thing I want to highlight in terms of if you really want to have a more innovative pharmaceutical system is we've got to reduce the hurdles and the costs of R&D development. Basically, what we've incentivized companies to do is avoid studying big public health problems like diabetes or heart disease, where the FDA, because these are big problems that affect tens of millions of Americans, you have to do these giant clinical trials with 50,000 patients that cost billions of dollars, the right side of this chart, and that costs a lot of money. And also, there are a lot of drugs already on the market for diabetes and heart disease and things like that. So what companies are incentivized to do is actually do the smaller clinical trials, which are much less expensive because you don't have to cover the healthcare for 10 patients. You do for 50,000 patients, a lot more money. And you have a lot more pricing power because those rare diseases, you might be the only drug on the market for that rare disease. So drug companies increasingly are studying these tiny diseases that maybe 1,000 Americans have where they can have high pricing power, charge $1 million per patient per year for the drug, and therefore if there are 1,000 patients, that's a $1 billion drug. They're not trying to study things like diabetes where there's 100 million patients, but where you don't have the pricing power. Those are the perverse incentives that we've created, and that's why these biologics represent less than 1% of prescriptions, but 60% of spending net of costs. So let me stop there. I know I've thrown a lot of information at you. You can read more about our work at freeop.org. You can go to drugs.freeop.org to find the drug coverage, and with that, I will stop, and I hope I haven't bored you. Thank you.
Oh, no. Very interesting. Members, is there anyone wishing to ask questions? Yes, Representative Anderson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, if you don't mind.
Go ahead. Okay.
Thank you, sir, for your presentation. Really appreciate this. I wanted to just ask a question on the slide that you spoke about of what Florida can do. Listed a couple different ideas there, several ideas. If one or a few of these were adopted in Florida, what impact do you see that happening nationwide? So, you know, I understand we're a very large market. I think you comment on that. I can't disagree with it. Probably similar to, you know, some of the countries in Europe. But in your opinion, how will other states handle, let's say, assuming we had adopted international reference pricing, for example, what will happen in Georgia or Alabama or
right,
the other
right.
states?
I mean, first of all, it would be a landmark reform to do this in Florida. Right? So no state has attempted to do this, especially when you think about applying it not just to government-sponsored programs like Medicaid and public employees, but to the employer market. The amount of money that would be saved for Florida consumers would be massive. It would be basically back-of-the-envelope calculations, and if people are interested, I can come back with a firmer analysis. But back-of-the-envelope, Florida consumers would probably save about $15 billion a year in drug spending from a reform like this. So the impact would be pretty significant. And a lot of that savings would, the first place those savings would accrue would be the employers, because their health insurance premium costs would go down, which makes basing a business in Florida more advantageous, right? So what is one of the big drivers? You know, you can talk tax policy all you want, but at the end of the day, a big driver for competitive businesses is how much does it cost to deliver health insurance to your employees? And if the cost of delivering health insurance is lower in Florida than it is in Georgia, that's a huge win and a huge advantage for Florida. So Georgia, particularly being a regional competitor, would have to look at that and say, okay, we're going to have to follow suit. If we don't, we're going to risk losing businesses across the border to Georgia. So I would think in particular the regional impact would be pretty significant, but overall I think you're going to see a lot of states look at that Florida model and say, hey, if Florida can do it, we should be able to do it too, especially if a Republican majority state is interested in this, and that's a policy that's going to attract a lot of attention.
And just to, you can ask your next question, but just to make sure everyone heard, I think you said your back of the envelope was $15
billion? $15 billion a year. Yeah, because if you think about it, so we spend roughly about $450 billion on prescription drugs in the country. If we say that just on a population basis, not even adjusting for the fact that Florida has a high healthcare consumption population, if we just say just on a proportional basis, that's about $30 billion a year in Florida. And we're talking about the fact that drug spending in the United States is double what it is in every other country. So, you know, let's say it's about, again, it's a, you know, $10 to $15 billion a year, depending on exactly where the math goes. And that's, again, that's like a huge tax cut, right? Not just for consumers, but for businesses. So it's a pretty significant economic effect. And all that disposable income then gets spent in the state of Florida. So it has a stimulative effect as well.
I just did the math just for what it was worth. If you divide $15 billion by 22 million people, it's $700 per person. Rep. Manderson, you're recognized if you had another question.
Thank you, Chair. My next question is around some of the gene therapies and cell therapies that you mentioned. I believe from us, the future of healthcare, future of medicine globally. It's also the most expensive type of treatments or cures that exist currently. Do you have any data on how those prices differ in Europe versus the United States? So you mentioned sickle cell, and that's something that's kind of front of mind for us here in Florida. Yeah. And we know this treatment's going to be well over $1 million, $2 million likely per individual. What kind of pricing do they have for that same treatment in Europe?
Yeah, it's too early now to have like clear data on the broad range of the broad spectrum of prices. Roughly speaking, what I can tell you is that for orphan drugs in general, of which this is kind of a category of orphan drugs, I mean, sickle cell is a pretty highly prevalent disease, so it's not exactly the same, but roughly speaking, orphan drug pricing in Europe is the gap there is not as big as it is for other things. I think for these cell-based therapies, you are going to see significant negotiation in Europe, but those negotiations take time. It takes a couple years for all that to flow through the system, so we don't know yet. But I would expect that, you know, if I had to forecast, and you know, I think one way to look at this, actually, if you want to get some accurate more accurate forecast than me just spitballing, is to look at what the Wall Street analyst reports are saying about what they're modeling for European prices versus U.S. prices. And generally speaking, I would expect to be about a 30% discount in Europe versus U.S.
Quick follow-up to that.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And then do you have any information or data on where most of that research is coming out of? So what I'm trying to understand is, as Americans, are we subsidizing the research and development for these gene and cell therapies globally?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, one way in which people talk about this big difference between U.S. pricing and international pricing, as everyone knows, look, we're paying for all this R&D spending by, you know, having double the prices, or actually it's not even double the prices, right? The prices are like 5x or 10x for some of these drugs than they are in Europe because so many of our drugs are generic. You know, we have so much more generic penetration in the U.S. versus other countries. So the price difference is massive here. And one way to look at that is, you know, we're subsidizing the development of a lot of these drugs. But I would say that it's not even that because, you know, if you look at the AbbVie Humira example, you know, where is all that subsidy going? It's not actually going to new innovation. You know, they're spending $44 billion to develop one new drug in their own labs. That's not a lot of innovation that we're subsidizing. We're subsidizing a lot of other things, you know, a lot of really nice corporate offices and, you know, a lot of bureaucracy. So, you know, it's not clear to me that the end result of all these high prices is more innovation. I think one thing that I think gets oversimplified is this idea that every dollar you spend on drug companies leads to another dollar of innovation. I think many of you understand in terms of government spending, just because you spend a dollar more on something doesn't mean you get a dollar more of results for it. That's not just true in the public sector. That's also true in the pharmaceutical industry. It's true in business in general.
Good. Last one.
Yep.
Thank you. So I think, you know, one of the concerns that I hear a lot, and I share it, is that, you know, if we have this more of a level playing field globally with drug prices, that R&D gets handicapped in some way. So, you know, that may or may not be true. In your opinion, when if drug cost, we bring drug costs down in Florida or throughout the United States, let's say, would you envision an environment where in other countries those costs come up? And I find it hard to believe manufacturers and drug companies are going to lose money over this. Right? They're going to find a way to still maintain profitability, still fund their R&D.
Yeah, let me break that question into two parts. So let's talk about the first part, which is this premise that if we have lower drug prices, we'll have less innovation. So should we quadruple the price of every drug in America so we have more innovation? Because if lower prices lead to less innovation, then surely higher prices lead to more innovation. So let's just quadruple the price of every drug in America. We'll have more innovation. Isn't that good for the world? I think most people would say, no, we shouldn't quadruple the price of every drug in America. There's a balance to be struck between what we pay for drugs and innovation. Like the iPhone in my pocket, we don't say to Apple, oh, yeah, you should charge $100,000 for an iPhone so you can have more innovative iPhones. We say to them, no, make a product at a price that consumers are willing to pay, and it's up to you to figure out how to innovate to make that deliver that product at the low cost that consumers will want. No one is entitled to just charge whatever they want and then say, oh, yeah, we need that money. You know, you have to give it to us, right? So I think it's really important to understand that if you believe that the only way we're going to get innovation is higher prices, then we should have quadruple the prices or 10x the price we have, because then we'll have more innovation. At a certain point, you have to decide where is the right balance between the prices we pay and the innovation we're getting. And I would argue that what we're spending and the innovation result we're getting is out of balance, particularly at those big companies, right? At startups, yes, there's a lot of innovation going at startups. The startups are getting funded through venture capital, through funds like the ones I used to work for. If you've got a good product, you're getting the investment from the market. And those investments will continue. Those investments existed 30 years ago. They existed 20 years ago at much lower price than we have now. And they'll exist tomorrow if we go back to the prices we had 10 years ago or 15 years ago or 20 years ago. So then the second part of your question was, okay, will prices go up potentially in these other countries if prices go down in the United States? That's a concern that's been raised. I don't see it. It's possible. And if that does happen, that's fine. Like from my standpoint, if Sanofi, a Franco-German multinational pharmaceutical company that makes a lot of drugs that a lot of us use, if they think that the way they're going to make up by having lower prices in the U.S. is having higher prices elsewhere, and they have the ability to negotiate those higher prices elsewhere, that's fine. They should have been doing that all along. I mean, if they're responsive to their shareholders, they should have been doing that all along. And it's malpractice on their part if they couldn't get higher prices from that standpoint, right? So I don't see it. I think that the leverage is what it is in these individual markets, and where the drug companies have more leverage is when their drug is a meaningful step change improvement on clinical outcomes, on medical outcomes. And where the countries have leverage is if they're big markets. Right? So small countries, small states don't have leverage because, you know, if you're Sanofi or Merck or Pfizer, you can say, okay, Greece, we don't care. You want to underpay us for our drug? We'll walk out of the Greek market. We don't care. But Germany, we can't walk out of the German market. It's too big of a market. It's too significant. So there's leverage on both sides. What's really important is that both sides have the ability to opt out. The drug company should have the ability to say, you know what? We think you're lowballing us. We're going to opt out of your market, and you lose access to this drug. And if that's okay for you, if you believe that's okay for your patients, then you have to deal with the consequences of that. That's the leverage the drug company has. And vice versa, the company wants access to that market. That's the leverage that the country has.
Thank you. Representative Masullo, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate your presentation. It was excellent. You know, as policymakers, we're looking at doing things to make our state better. I'm really bothered by the fact that now almost 10% of our medium household income in Florida is consumed by healthcare costs. And you've done a good job of trying to divide out how that healthcare cost is actually allocated and how we pay for it through our insurance. But what you didn't mention is where the rate of change is the greatest. And I can tell you it's not in physician services, and I can tell you that by experience. But I can also tell you that it is possibly in the cost of pharmaceuticals. And my question is, can you give us some of that breakdown?
Yeah, so that's a great question. What are the trends where, you know, in terms of this is just a snapshot, how are these things trending or changing over time? And where we have the most visibility is actually in the Medicare program. We have it for everything, but particularly in the Medicare program, I can tell you that the by far the biggest drivers of growth in Medicare spending are specialist physician care and prescription drugs. Hospital is actually relatively stable in Medicare, and primary care is stable in Medicare because primary care physicians are kind of, they have the least negotiating leverage. In private insurance, it's a little bit different. In private insurance, pharmaceutical spending is a big driver of growth, also labs and specialist care. And primary care is not a driver of growth, but hospital spending is. Hospital spending is more of a driver in the employer-based setting than it is in Medicare, because in Medicare, there's, it's the government negotiates the, or asserts the prices we're going to pay for stuff, and that affects Medicare Advantage as well. So if you're in Medicare, your hospital rates are somewhat controlled, whereas if you are non-elderly or the normal employer-sponsored market like I am, then the hospitals have more leverage, particularly in parts of the country where there's a regional hospital monopoly. They can, you as an insurer, you don't have the ability to say, okay, I'll send you this other hospital if your prices are too high over here, because one system controls the entire region, and so you're forced to use that hospital's network or that health system's network. Florida's a little bit more competitive than most places, so you're fortunate in that regard. And so in a place like Florida, drugs, I would think, would be a bigger problem.
Yep, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a different question. You mentioned on launching drugs, oftentimes that the manufacturer is going to be more, I'll use the term, reasonable with pricing. Have you looked at, and it's easy to see because we've had several biologics come out in the last couple of years, and we'll probably get a lot more in all forms, both intravenous, intramuscular, as well as oral. Have you looked at those initial launched prices in other countries and compared the disparity that we're seeing after the drug's been on the market for several years?
I haven't done that analysis in the think tank context, but when I was an investor, we looked at this stuff all the time. And again, every country in Europe is a little different in how they do this, so there's not a European Union-wide approach to negotiating drug prices. But what I can tell you is that the different approaches yield the different results. So, to give an example, in Germany, they had this really interesting system, which was reformed about 10, 15 years ago, actually. They had this really interesting system where in year one, they have what's called free pricing. So in year one, to accelerate access to the drug on the market, they say to the drug company, okay, once you've been approved by the European Medicines Agency, charge whatever you want to charge. You know, you negotiate with the insurers. It's up to you, but you can do whatever you want. And then they only come in and create this kind of negotiation structure. It's not so much government-driven. It's more the insurance companies kind of as a group. It's sort of like the insurance company trade association negotiates with the drug company trade association. They have this interesting model that way. But that negotiation kind of comes in after year one. So in that way, that's a tool they use to accelerate access to the market. Because what happens in other countries, like the UK, in the UK they say, you can't launch here until we finished our negotiation. And so the negotiation takes a couple of years, and then they haggle over the price, then the price finally gets settled, and then they launch the drug. So in the UK, it takes a little longer to get the drugs approved, even though pharmaceutical companies prioritize launching in the UK market, compared to a country like Germany, where it's a little faster. But the end result is, in general, the launch prices are lower in Europe than they are in the U.S., not higher. So going to this point about would launch prices go up in the U.S. if you negotiated or had an international benchmark for prices, no, they wouldn't. Because, again, you don't have the leverage unless, by state law or federal law, you're forcing the insurer to pay for that drug. So to give example, at the federal level, in Medicare Part D, so Medicare Part D is the prescription drug benefit for retail prescription drugs, so drugs you buy at CVS or Walgreens. There are six protected classes where the insurer has to cover those drugs irrespective of their price. And so if you are a biotech company or a pharma company, you develop a drug in one of those protected classes, you're golden. You can charge whatever you want. The drug company has to pay the price, and that gets filtered down to seniors' premiums. On the other hand, if it's not in a protected class, like a cholesterol-lowering drug or a blood pressure-lowering drug, those are not protected classes, there you have to negotiate with the insurers, with the PBMs, et cetera. And if you're trying to overcharge, they just won't put it on the formula, or they'll put you on the highest tier of the formulary where you have a high copay, et cetera. And that process has worked really well. So Part D, Medicare Part D, came in way under budget because the role of this negotiation process did a lot to bring down drug spending in a way that it hadn't been done before. It led to a lot of the, it's part of the reason why we have such high a role for generic drugs in the U.S. compared to other countries.
One quick.
Yep, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it seems that we would be paying more here in the United States even for a launch drug, relatively speaking. My last question is the delta on that increase over time. I'm sure in Europe they're increasing it some as well. Do we pay a much higher delta as well?
Yes. So I think if I get the train of your questions, it's, you know, we're paying more at every step. Our launch prices are higher than peer countries. The rate of increase in prices is way higher than in other countries. And as we all know, the power of compound interest, you know, if you compound those 10, 15% price increases year after year after year, by year 10, you're paying way more. A study I did about 10 years ago now, I looked at multiple sclerosis drugs. If you looked at sort of Avonex, which was the first biotech multiple sclerosis drug from a company called Biogen in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that drug, they were charging six times as much by year 10 as what they were charging when they launched the drug. And that was obviously not the case in these European countries, where one of the things they do is say, okay, you can increase your prices by inflation, CPI inflation, but not 10, 15% a year. So the delta becomes a lot worse over time. And this is where the international benchmarks, you'll see the power. So if Florida were to adopt the international benchmarking approach, where you'd particularly see the savings is in these drugs that have been around for 5, 10 years. Newly launched drugs, you would see some effect, and that effect would grow over time. But the immediate impact, the immediate savings in year one, in year two for Floridians, would be in those drugs that have been on the market for 5 to 10 years. And to that point, if you're the pharmaceutical industry, you should be like, okay, you know, these are drugs that have been on the market for a long time. We've paid back by several multiples our R&D investment in that drug. We're okay.
Okay, Representative Cross, you were recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a couple questions.
That's fine.
All right, thank you. Thank you for this presentation. We do like presentations in this committee.
Particularly on this subject.
Yes, yes. Wanted to look at kind of what you perceive as the difference in effectiveness between biologics and small molecule drugs. And just looking if there's a rationale besides potentially the regulatory structure and the potential financial incentives, is there a reason why we're using biologics versus small molecules for certain disease states?
Leaving the economics of drug development and pricing aside, looking purely at clinical outcomes, it's case by case. You can't really generalize, but there's a couple ways in which you can generalize. One aspect of generalization is that biologics, because they're much bigger molecules, when they're in your body, they can't always access every kind of tissue because a large biologic doesn't cross certain cellular barriers and things like that. So they have to work in certain ways, and they can target certain kinds of cellular processes, which sometimes can be better. Sometimes that results in a better, more targeted effect. Sometimes that's not good because you don't get into the organs or the tissues or the compartments of your body that you need to that you can more easily access with a smaller drug. So that's one element of that can be different depending on the disease. The other is that typically you're more likely to be able to have an oral version of your drug, a pill or a liquid that you can consume orally, if it's a small molecule. If it's a biologic, typically that has to be injected, either an injection like a pen or an IV infusion. So for a patient, the vast majority of patients would much prefer to have a pill than to have an injection or an infusion. So typically, that's the real value of a small molecule drug. So what you're seeing, for example, in this new space with Ozempic and Wegovy and these kinds of drugs, those are pens right now. You have to inject them. But the next generation of GLP-1 inhibitors, which is the mechanism by which these drugs work, glucagon-like peptide 1, that the next generation of these drugs are oral. And once you have oral versions of GLP-1s, more people will take them. And the pricing leverage, because they're not biologics, they're small molecules, will be, if we have the system we have today, those drugs will go off patent. The economic value of those drugs will be much greater over time for the public because they'll become cheaper over the long term in a way that biologics do not. Does that answer your question? Okay.
You're recognized.
Thank you. So the examples, like the five, seems like the five costliest drugs that you presented, the biologics, mm-hmm. were for rheumatoid arthritis or certain forms of cancer. Mm-hmm. When you have a disease like that compared to something that's more prolific within society, are pharmaceutical companies making a decision about essentially two pathways to go? Because looking at like Ozempic, if the first step is creating a biologic and then potentially that's leading to a small molecule drug, I'm just wondering if that's a necessary first step in providing treatment to people that need it and then something else follows, or if this really is purely an examination of what regulatory structure is better for the bottom line and for, you know, control of, you know, of that market.
It's generally the latter. It's generally that the incentives are more powerful with a biologic drug than a small molecule. However, if you're a drug developer, what you ultimately want is a drug that works. If you're going to be more likely to have success with a small molecule in terms of having a drug that, you know, is an increase in improvement on the standard of care that can be approved by the FDA that'll meet test, you know, it'll pass the clinical trials, that's the most important thing. Like, you know, you're going to be agnostic about small molecule versus biologic in terms of that. You want, what's most important is you meet those hurdles. If you believe that you can meet those hurdles with either approach, that's when the incentives are much more powerful to develop a biologic. That's one way of answering your question. Another thing that happens is there'll be in academic labs, someone will identify a gene or a biological or cellular process that they think is connected to a disease, like a rare form of cancer, say. And if you, for example, let's say, just to make an example up, let's say I'm an academic scientist and I've discovered that if a particular cellular protein is mutated in this way, specific way, that leads to a rare form of cancer that 5,000 Americans will have. Well, it's very easy then for a biotech company, for me as a scientist, to start the biotech company, or maybe somebody else, to say, oh, okay, if we know that this mutated protein leads to this cancer that 5,000 people have, it's very easy for me to make a monoclonal antibody to soak up that protein, to target that specific protein, and have beneficial clinical outcomes for those 5,000 patients. So it's not actually that innovative scientifically. We've been doing this now for decades. But that biologic drug, it's very easy to target that process with a biologic drug. So particularly when it comes to cancer and some other particularly rare cancers, where you know the genetic mutation or the genetic problem that's causing that particular cancer, it's really easy, really straightforward to use a monoclonal antibody to target that process. So that's often why it starts that way. It's easier scientifically and mentally to develop a monoclonal antibody, and you get all these economic benefits as well.
Okay. Ranking Member Skidmore, you're recognized for the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for spending some time with me this morning to talk about this incredibly important issue. As we discussed, you know, biologics are pretty important to me and my life. A lot of my colleagues know I've had rheumatoid arthritis since I was 4 years old, so I've been taking medications for 57 years. And the biologics are clearly different, and clearly the next four-year-old who is diagnosed with JRA or RA will not have some of the same joint damage that those of us who have been dealing with for a long time have. So there's obviously a big savings there. My question, thank you, Mr. Chair, is in when talking about the pharmaceutical companies not investing in new innovation, I'm hoping you can help me understand how buying a new innovation for $11 billion and making that more accessible isn't still some level of innovation, rather than hiring the scientist who actually discovers the way in which the medication can be delivered or the disease can be attacked. Isn't that still part of innovation, and does it count for anything?
Great question. So, like all things in healthcare, there's some nuance to it. But to use the example that I mentioned before, so Gilead buying Pharmasset, that was purely an example of financial engineering, in my view, because the drug had already. I was literally at the scientific meeting where Pharmasset presented its clinical data, and they showed that this drug basically was curing hepatitis C. There was a gasp in the room when the data was presented. It was such a transformative scientific milestone. The next day, Gilead bought the drug. So Gilead did not invest any. All the clinical work, all the legwork in bringing that drug to the point where we knew that it cured hepatitis C was done by the startup company, Pharmasset. All Gilead did was bought the company, then put their sales force in charge of selling it, and charged way more than Pharmasset would have charged, because Pharmasset didn't need to charge as much as Gilead to get a return on their R&D expenditure, right? They could have charged a lot less and made all of their investors and all their founders very rich. But Gilead, in order to recoup their investment, because they paid so much more for the company than Pharmasset would have had to sell it for, they had to then double, triple, quadruple the price in order to make their money back. So Pharmasset stock, I don't remember the exact, this is like more than 10 years ago, so you're testing my memory, but let's say Pharmasset's market cap after this data was like $2 billion, and then Gilead comes and buys them for $11 billion, right? So Pharmasset, as a $2 billion company, having spent maybe $100 million on the development of this drug, or maybe $200 million at this point, they don't have to charge that much to make their $200 million back. But Gilead, buying Pharmasset for $11 billion, they have to make $11 billion in profit on that drug in order to make their money back, right? So what they have to charge is much more. Now, having said that, there are what we might call middle cases. There are cases in lots of different directions, but let's take a middle case where, let's say you've developed a new drug for diabetes, and diabetes is a disease, as we've talked about, that 100 million Americans have. So if you're a small startup and you've developed a promising drug for diabetes, it will cost you $5 billion to do the phase 3 trials, because the FDA has made it that expensive to do phase 3 trials. So if you don't have $5 billion, that's where the big cash-rich companies can come in and fund those trials. Or maybe it's the sales force, the $5 billion you want to spend on the sales force to reach those 100 million patients. The Pfizers and the Mercks have those sales forces. Now, I wouldn't say that's good. I would say it's a problem. It's a policy problem that it costs that much to reach 100 million patients, and that it costs $5 billion to do a diabetes trial. Let's work on that and make it less expensive so you don't have to sell those assets. Another example is COVID vaccines. So we think of the Pfizer COVID vaccine. Well, Pfizer didn't develop the COVID vaccine that we call the Pfizer vaccine. It was developed by a German startup called BioNTech, right? That basically Pfizer acquired the U.S. rights to that drug because they knew how to negotiate the U.S. governmental system to sell the vaccine into Operation Warp Speed that this German startup didn't have, right? So that was an example of Pfizer acquiring an asset purely because they were savvy about how to work the U.S. government in a way that a German startup wouldn't be. And so Pfizer added value by having that capability that a German startup wouldn't have. So yes, there are examples of where a larger company will add value. And yes, there could be areas where
you know, you have a startup that has a drug for, say, rheumatoid arthritis, but there's a bigger company that already has experience in that field. They have a lot of knowledge about rheumatoid arthritis, so maybe they add some incremental value in the development of that drug because of the capability they have in those cases. But generally speaking, the American pharmaceutical industry would benefit from having 1,000 flowers bloom, right? Have these startups be able to take their own drugs to market, make those founders rich, make those help those companies grow over time so that they're the next Genzyme or the next Biogen or the next Genentech emerges from that startup, as opposed to that company getting acquired by Pfizer and getting lost in the bureaucracy of Pfizer. As we've shown, the R&D productivity of these big companies in terms of their own labs is very, very low. We're going to have a much more innovative, much more productive biotech and pharmaceutical industry if there's more diversity, if we have 1,000 smaller and mid-sized companies than a handful of big players where everything gets lost in the bureaucracy.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. And I follow along. But then my question is, what's the, and I don't know if this is the right word, but culpability of Pharmasset for selling then? Because Pharmasset didn't have to sell. So, you know, where do we get to differentiate who's greedier? And how do we do that without understanding that if Pfizer didn't bring the COVID vaccine to the United States of America, what would have happened? So, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I think that there's an intrinsic value that's not getting factored in. If you could address that, I'd appreciate it.
So in the specific case of Pharmasset, Pharmasset did have to sell because Pharmasset was a publicly traded company. And so when you're a publicly traded company and an acquirer comes in with a bid that multiplies your stock price by 5, the board of directors of that company, Pharmasset, has a fiduciary duty to its shareholders to entertain the bid. And unless they can find another acquirer who's going to pay the same price, they have to accept it, because they're not doing their fiduciary duty by their shareholders by rejecting that bid that would make their shareholders 5 times richer. So Pharmasset really had no choice but to accept that offer, and I'm not saying that they didn't want to accept the offer. You know, they were probably perfectly happy to accept the offer because that made all of them rich too. But there are legal boundaries there. Now, if it was a private company, if it was a privately held company, a venture-backed startup that wasn't in the publicly traded markets, that's a little different. Then they do have the choice to sell or not, but they often do because they want the, you know, it's that old bird in the hand versus, you know, what's the expression? So, you're gonna take the money if it's there, if you believe the acquisition price is attractive. What I would say is that I don't blame Pharmasset for selling. I don't even blame Gilead for buying in the sense that these are the incentives that we have created for the industry. But these are not good incentives. It's not good that the incentive that we have is, instead of Pharmasset taking that drug to market and curing hepatitis as a startup, we've created the incentive for Gilead to pay $11 billion and overcharge for the drug to make that money back. That's the decision that lawmakers have made. That's not a decision that a free market on its own would have necessarily made. That's my point.
Members, anyone else wishing to ask? Yes, Representative Grant, you had a question.
Thank you, Chairman. And again, thank you for meeting with me this morning and for your presentation here today. A little, I guess, off tangent to what Representative Skidmore is talking about, and we touched upon it in our meeting today. Tell me how artificial intelligence is going to impact drug development, not just in this country, but as we know, there's a lot of smart people in the rest of the world, including India and Europe and whatever. Can you tell us how that is going to impact speculation, not only drug development, but also, I guess, long-term drug costs and where you see us 10, 15 years down the road?
I think that AI, what we're already seeing is that AI is going to turbocharge drug development on the early side. So let me give you a kind of a very brief description of how drug development works. So let's say you want to treat Alzheimer's disease. You have to have a scientific hypothesis of how you're going to treat Alzheimer's disease. Let's say, as has been common, people have used, there are these things called amyloid plaques that build up in the brain, and a lot of people have had the idea of if we can reduce or eliminate or wash out these amyloid plaques or break them down, maybe that will cure Alzheimer's. So a lot of people have tried to do that, and you can come up with different biochemical processes or mechanisms by which to wash out those amyloid plaques. You then have to test a lot of different molecules to see if those molecules will actually wash out the amyloid plaques and whether it'll be safe and effective in patients. And then you have to do the clinical trials to measure, are you actually having an effect on Alzheimer's disease? Is the cognition of these patients improving or at least declining at a less quick rate through your drug? And then you file that data with the FDA and they review it, and then if they like it, they approve your drug. That second half of the equation can't really get slowed down because you're doing the clinical trial in Alzheimer's disease, you have to look at the patients over a particular time period, say 2 years or a year or whatever it is. The FDA has to go over that data with a fine-tooth comb and look at all the paperwork. All that's going to take time. Some of that you can trim down a little bit maybe with technology, but you still have to look at the patients and follow the course of the disease over a particular period of time in order to see whether the patients get better or worse. So from a time standpoint, it's hard to really trim that down a lot, that back half. But the front end, you can really trim down. So one of the things that this company called DeepMind did that has now been acquired by Google is they did, it used to be that one of the things you had to really figure out and took a lot of trial and error from biotech and pharma companies was, let's say you wanted to develop this antibody to the protein target, or if you want to develop a small molecule drug, you want to figure out how to hit this little pocket in that particular protein that's causing the biologic effect that you want to treat. You'd have to test out a lot of different things and use a lot of computer modeling, say, okay, if I design a molecule that's shaped like this, will it fit into this pocket in the enzyme and tweak it? And if I develop that drug, will it then have side effects or toxins? You have to do all this stuff really through trial and error, and that's why R&D productivity is what it is. There's a lot of trial and error, a lot of failures. So this company, DeepMind, they actually solved this by, through brute force artificial intelligence, predicting, looking at all the existing knowledge we have about how DNA sequences lead to certain proteins that are shaped a certain way. They can now predict basically what any DNA sequence, how that DNA sequence will not only lead to a certain amino acid sequence, that's the basic biochemistry we've known for 50 years, but also how that protein will then fold and shape into a, like this kind of curvy ball thing that then has a biological effect. All that is now being predictable through AI. It used to be you didn't know. That was guesswork. Now it's completely determined by AI. So your ability to go from having 10,000 drug candidates that you're using to cure Alzheimer's in this particular way to having 5 or 2 or 1 that you want to take into clinical trials, that part has been trimmed down massively. And to kind of get to your point about the international piece of it, this technology is available. You know, other countries, other AI companies can do the same thing that DeepMind did. DeepMind just plugged into the scientific literature to develop the tool, the database that they developed. Any company could do the same thing. And that means that it's going to be a lot easier for countries around the world or companies around the world to use that technology to bring new candidates to the clinic. They'll still have to get approved. If they want to access the U.S. market, they'll still have to get approved by the FDA to launch in the U.S. But it does mean that the drug market will get more competitive over time. And one thing that's really important to this point about the U.S. drug industry is that, you know, the U.S. is not the only country that develops innovative medicines. There are lots of innovative companies in Germany, in Switzerland, in the U.K. A lot of the big pharmaceutical companies are based in those countries. Novartis, Roche are based in Switzerland. Sanofi is based in France and Germany. GlaxoSmithKline and AstraZeneca are based in the U.K. Those are some of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world. And so when we talk about the $49 billion, maybe at least in the case of AbbVie, you can say, well, hey, AbbVie's based in Chicago, so that's a great wealth transfer to Chicago. Maybe we like Chicago, at least the Chicagoans who've moved here. But if you're transferring that money to Switzerland, how is that serving Americans? Right? If the point of this whole system is what are we doing to serve American innovation and American industry, it's not clear that subsidizing Swiss innovators or Swiss pharmaceutical multinational companies is the way to do that.
Members, anyone else wishing to ask a question? What? Okay. Well, seeing none, thank you for your presentation. It was very, very interesting, I think very helpful. So, members, that concludes our agenda for today. I will not be the reason you have to show up next week or stay late. We'll be right in the middle of the block, but I do anticipate that we'll be meeting next week when we meet on Tuesday. Seeing no further business, Representative Barrero moves we rise. With that, we're adjourned.